You're listening to 91.3 FM WTSR at the College of New Jersey. My name is Sarah Neal.
I'm Allison Silver.
And we're here in the studio with Kurt Foxworth, the director of Shakespeare's 70s upcoming production of William Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew at the Don Evans Black Box Theater here in Kendall Hall at the College of New Jersey. Kurt, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I wanted to start off by just asking generally, how are you, how are rehearsals going for the show in general?
Well, we only actually have two rehearsals left, so the rehearsals are intense. We are spending a lot of time getting a lot done, but we are reaching the point where it's really clear what the show actually is, what it's going to look like, and we can start to imagine the audience being there and how both the show and the audience will kind of come alive in each other's presence.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yes.
Can you introduce yourself? Tell the listeners a little bit about who you are.
Well, I'm Kurt Foxworth. I'm actually a 2002 graduate of TCNJ, and I'm an executive committee member with Shakespeare 70, which is a non-professional theater group here in Central Jersey that we work at TCNJ, and we also work at Kelsey Theater at Mercer County Community College. We were actually founded by a TCNJ faculty member, Frank Arith, back in 1970. So we've been doing shows for over 50 years in the area. We do a lot of Shakespeare. We do a lot of classical work. But when we're doing that work for audiences here at TCNJ, we're always trying to think about how to do it in a way that would speak to or reach a modern college-aged audience, because we've actually had some really great experiences with the audiences here just being really open and being really curious to see theater in a way they haven't seen it before.
Definitely. My next question that goes right into it was, could you tell me about your history with TCNJ? So maybe your major and some of your favorite courses, maybe even?
I majored in English here at TCNJ, graduated in 2002. I have to say that what I remember most about being here was doing theater here with ACT, and I was in the mixed signals, and actually moved to Chicago to study improv after I graduated here because of my time doing theater and mixed signals. But in English, I think at the time there was a creative writing professor here named Kathy Day, who since went on to another university, and she taught creative writing, and that was really, I learned more about theater from creative writing than I did from a lot of like dramatic lit that I'd studied, because it was so much focused on, her work was focused on teaching students how a story worked, how it worked and why it worked and how it could work better. And I think that that ultimately planted seeds for me that when I began directing plays later on, I just kind of always had an idea of how the play was working and how I, as the director, could help the play or the story work. And I think a lot of that came from those three creative writing classes that I had here. But also I took some really fun dramatic lit, got to read a lot of plays. There were film classes that were run in English back at the time, and I took some of those as well. But I was always really looking for a chance to read plays. And when I was creative writing, when I was doing creative writing, I was trying to write a lot of dialogue. So that was, theater was always kind of where my heart was.
Yeah. Do you have any notable productions from, like, you remember from your ACT times or your mixed signals times?
Oh, I remember what they were, but because I'm a director now, I think back of them. I think back on them, and I just think, and this is what it needed, and this is and this is how it didn't work, and this is why it wasn't successful. Which, like, maybe sounds a little joyless, but I mean, because I love theater so much and because I feel like I've grown like as a theater artist since then, I think part of it is really being able to look at your own work and see where it needs to grow and how it needs to grow. But I would say that there was something about ACT that endures, which is really that they have to do it all themselves. There isn't really an institutional program here that's letting students work on straight plays, non-musicals.
Yeah.
And from the time I was in college until now, there has been a really robust organization that gets the money from SFB and puts on their own productions. Sometimes there are 50 people working on a production, and it's really collaborative and it's amazing. And I appreciated it when I was here, and it means a lot to me to see it still thriving.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what did that transition from like being a performer to being a director look like?
I think part of it was realizing that my ability as a performer is really limited. Like, I feel like I've been in some plays and I've done a good job, but I think that I am not as flexible as a lot of the actors we work with. So I do a good job if it's a good part for me. Mm-hmm. But I have friends and colleagues who can do all sorts of parts. And I think, though, that I saw a lot of theater. Mm-hmm. I watched a lot of plays when I went here. When I graduated here, I saw a lot of theater. I moved to Chicago. I saw tons of plays. I gave a directing workshop for the ACT students last spring, and as I was putting together my thoughts for them, I realized I had probably seen over 200 plays before I even directed a play. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of productions under my belt that I was able to think about and take from and learn from. So that transition felt pretty seamless for me. And I think once I started directing, I was like, oh yeah, this is the part of theater that I actually like the best. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while you direct a couple plays in a row and then you're like, oh, I'd like to act in something now, because all I need to do is learn the lines and show up at rehearsal. Mm-hmm. And I don't have to think about the lights. I don't have to think about the costumes. I don't have to think about all of the moving pieces the way the director does, which, I mean, you do. It's hard.
Yeah. What motivated you to want to start directing?
I think it was, and I've kind of described this to other friends of mine in theater or friends who are interested in directing. When you're younger and you're doing theater, you're so often watching a play and just thinking about what are the actors doing. Mm-hmm. And your critique of the play is, well, this performance was good and that performance was bad. But I think I started noticing that I was looking at the whole production and that I was thinking about how the story was being told, or how the different elements of the production, the lighting, the sound, the costumes, were working together with the actors. And I think that I started seeing plays and critiquing them as a whole. And when I did that, it was a way of realizing, oh, your interest here is actually in the whole picture. It's not in this, just in this piece of it, which would be acting. And, you know, there are a lot of really talented actors who aren't interested in directing and who certainly can look at a play as an entire piece. But I think it's common for you to always focus on the thing that you feel you know best. So now when I watch a play, I'm almost always looking at it for the directing.
Sure.
What is the appeal in directing Shakespeare for you?
One, it's in the public domain. So I've directed plays that were not in the public domain, so even modern American plays, and I've really loved the text of the play itself. But I have sometimes felt like, oh, my job here is just to make sure everyone learns their lines and stands in the right place. And it just doesn't feel like it's as creative an experience for me. But with Shakespeare, when you read a Shakespeare play, Shakespeare doesn't tell you anything about what the setting looks like. You sometimes pick it out from the dialogue. He doesn't tell you what people are wearing. He doesn't tell you a lot about what people look like, except sometimes you hear things in the dialogue. So there's this huge freedom to imagine a setting, a location, a time period. The fact that it's in the public domain means that you can cut and alter the play. And I try not to rewrite or change the play too much. If I do, it's usually only to kind of illuminate something for the audience. It's not that I'm taking Shakespeare's text and I'm trying to say, well, I don't like this speech, I'm going to rewrite it and I want it to sound a different way. Mm-hmm. No, we use the words that we're given. It's usually that I'm taking a play that maybe is 2.5 hours and cutting it down to 1 hour and 40 minutes, partially because that kind of compression actually makes the events of the play more intense. Mm-hmm. And it's easier for a modern audience to watch something that's a little shorter. I mean, in Elizabethan England, people who went to the theater had all day. It was their, yeah. It was one of their sole sources of major entertainment. And mm-hmm. here we have so many choices. And so you do want to be cognizant of the audience's time and that you're always making decisions that are respectful of their time. So like a 4-hour Shakespeare play to me would be a lot on our budget. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you were to go to Broadway and see a 4-hour Shakespeare play where they could create this set for $2 million, right, and they had a composer write an entire score to it, to the tune of $200,000, and then they're hiring the best actors in the world with the best training, you still might find 4 hours to be a little too long, but you might endure it more than if you are like at your local theater and you're dealing with people who are, you know, volunteers. Like our organization is a volunteer organization. We're doing it for the love of the game. Mm-hmm. So I think part of it is using people's time well.
Yeah, yeah.
But Shakespeare also, to get back to your question, it really is such a blank slate. Mm. And we hear the words and they mean something different to us now than they meant to the audience in 1600. And I think that's exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about theater and that is enduring about classics, is that even if this piece seems a little old fashioned, there might be something inside of it that really does still speak to who we are right now. Mm-hmm. And that if we can find those things, that it's worth telling that story. And I do mm-hmm. think Shakespeare is, I mean, the size of the canon, it's pretty impressive. And, mm-hmm. you know, of the 35 or so plays, I mean, I think at least 20 plus, you can find something really interesting at any given moment to mm-hmm. to bring to a modern audience,
yeah,
with some work.
Definitely. How did you first get involved in Shakespeare 70 specifically?
I was a student here and I had done a production, I think my junior year, and the founder of Shakespeare 70, who was still at the time teaching in the English department, mm-hmm. Dr. Arith, saw me in that production, and he was going to be doing something over the summer, and he just asked me if I was available and if I'd want to do a role. And I was I played Francis Flute in A Midsummer Night's Dream. Oh. And it was outside at Washington's Crossing State Park, which is not an amazing venue.
It would rain.
It was really hot. We'd be in these like really heavy costumes, and it was buggy, and if it rained and the show would be canceled, and you weren't that disappointed because the conditions of performing it were really unpleasant. But I loved doing plays, so it was like, I think going to rehearsal was as much fun as actually doing the show. But that was, I think, after the spring semester of my junior year, so that would have been 2001, that was my first Shakespeare 70 show. Uh-huh.
That's so exciting.
So then what is the first play that you directed for Shakespeare 70?
The first play I directed for Shakespeare 70 was a play called The Vortex by Noel Coward. And I directed it locally at a venue called the West Windsor Arts Center, which we don't perform there anymore. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really a theater. They had like 10 lighting instruments and kind of an open space. But, you know, Noel Coward was gay and wrote sometimes in a coded way mm-hmm. about his male characters. And as a gay person myself, I was just really drawn to that play. I read it. I knew it wasn't a play that a lot of people knew, but I felt like there was something really interesting there. And I think my goal was for the audience to see the play and think, oh, how come I haven't seen this play before? Mm-hmm. Like, how come I don't know this play? This is actually a really good play.
Yeah.
So that was the first play I directed, and that was maybe 12 years ago. So since then, it's been almost a play a year, sometimes two, since then.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
What's the most challenging production that you have directed? It can be Shakespeare 70 or not. And what did you take away from that?
I think it was a production of, it was the first play that we did, Shakespeare 70 did when we returned to TCNJ, which was in the fall of 2018. Mm-hmm. And it was a play called Clybourne Park by Bruce Norris. It had won the Pulitzer Prize. It's a really amazing piece of writing. But what I learned from it was, and this isn't the kind of play that I'm a good match to direct, mm-hmm. because I don't want my effort to go into, like, just making sure we know the lines and we're standing in the right place and the show's moving. Like, I didn't feel, or I had not figured out as a director how it would be a creative pursuit for me as well. So mm-hmm. I guess I just found it frustrating. Plus, it was just our first show back, and yeah. I and you know, some of my colleagues at Shakespeare 70, we felt like we had a lot of pressure to put on a really great show so that the people who invited us back to the college saw that we were doing work that was worth their time and attention. And we did get a good response, but, like, you can't control what the... Oftentimes, you are frustrated by something, and then it gets in front of the audience, and it works for the audience. So you have to kind of, like, forgive yourself for the thing that didn't go well for you during rehearsal or the thing that was a challenge. You have to kind of just focus on, well, the audience responded really well to it. Our constituents at TCNJ were really happy. They asked us back the next year to do another show. And, of course, now we have this relationship with them where we're working on a show in the fall and then another show in the spring. Mm-hmm. So that was the production that got it rolling. It was just, it was very hard. And it was a hard lesson for me to learn on a production where I felt the stakes were really high. Mm-hmm. That it's not, ultimately, I'm better with something that where I have a little more flexibility to create a vision for the play as opposed to executing the playwright's vision for the play. Which the playwright is entitled to, and he's one of the most amazing writers we have in American theater. It's just that I realized, oh, that's not what you do really well.
On the other hand, what is your favorite that you've directed?
I feel like it's almost always like the last thing that I did. In the fall last year, I directed the students of ACT in a production of Macbeth. And I'm not even that wild about Macbeth as a play. It's, like, not one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
I had such a good experience working with the students, and I had a really specific idea. I worked with, like, 12 students plus a production team that was totally on board from the word go, and everyone just felt so committed to it that by the time it closed, I was like, oh, wow, like, from beginning to end, I don't know that I've ever really gotten a production to be exactly what I wanted it to be, like this one was.
Wow.
And I mean, there are obviously there's different variation. Like, the students here they're really novices. They're untrained mm-hmm. actors. They are people who love theater and are just trying it for fun. It's an activity. Mm-hmm. But whether I'm working with people who are, like, untrained or who are novices or people who have tons of experience, sometimes it's the energy that they're just bringing into the experience that can drive you through it. And I hope that in a week I'm saying that my favorite thing that I've ever done is this play. But I won't know until it's over.
Yeah. Sure. In the vein of talking about, like, adapting scripts and adaptation for the stage specifically, do you have a choice that you made in the directorial process that you think was most unique or most interesting, like, as an adaptation choice?
For Timmy of the Shrew? Or for
any of the plays that you've directed? But we can talk about Timmy of the Shrew.
I would say that if I'm adapting something, first, I don't really think of it as adapting mm-hmm. because I'm not really writing the script myself. It's more that I'm editing the script. Mm-hmm. I would feel like I was adapting something if I were doing like an Ibsen play or a Chekhov play and I got a literal translation and then I was trying to write a modern language English version of mm-hmm. that literal. That would feel like more of an adaptation yeah. to me. But I have seen productions of Shakespeare that have been described as an adaptation and I don't feel it's any different from what I'm doing. So mm-hmm. I think it's just semantics.
Yeah,
I don't.
Yeah.
I would say though that the question is, why are you doing... To me, the question is always like, well, why are we doing it now?
Mm-hmm.
This play is really old. What's the point in doing it right now? And I think there's always a version of it that's, well, there are words in this play that are worth hearing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there are words in this play that we haven't quite heard in this way.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to think too much about other specific productions of that particular play, but I'm usually aware of maybe a reputation that the play has. I think that I've directed Romeo and Juliet before, As You Like It, Julius Caesar, all these Shakespeares, and they all kind of come with their own baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm trying to shake off the baggage a little bit, but then once I kind of come up with my idea, I really try not to pay attention to like that baggage or the history of the play. And I'm just trying to do this play right now. Like no one's ever done it before. I would say that I can't think of a Shakespeare play though that I've ever directed where we used period costumes except for one, and it was a specific choice that we used period costumes in one location, and then when the play moved to a different location it became modern for the rest of the play, and it kind of became about trying to shake an old-fashioned idea and embracing the modern, because to me that was something that was happening with the characters anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it has always been modern, and I think that's the best way to bring it to students.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's more accessible for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. But that period costume choice is fascinating.
I was happy with it.
Yeah.
I was happy with it. And it happened on stage, too. They walked from one side of the stage to the next. And, like, halfway through, they, like, took off their period costumes, and underneath they had modern costumes, and then all these people came out in modern costumes and started playing music, and the lights changed, and... Yeah, no, that was a good one.
What production was that?
It was
that
As
for?
You Like It.
As You Like It. Awesome.
There's actually an actor in my play right now who was in that production of As You Like It, and I've been working with her since she was a freshman here.
Wow.
And now she's, like... I think she's, like... maybe 4 or 5 years out of school. Mm. She's been a teacher for all these years, but I still work with her because she's part of our company now.
Wow. Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Is there a dream show that you would like to direct one day?
I think I do it. And then I find another one.
Mm-hmm.
So for a long time, I really wanted to direct As You Like It. And then I did. So I was like, well, okay, I've got to direct something else. Okay, and now I want to direct Richard III. Mm. And I did. And at that point, I think it's just, I'm not a director who has like a long list of plays that I want to direct. I think I direct one or two things. And then I'm like, okay, what's the next thing I'm interested in? And I kind of don't have anything until I have the next idea.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to direct a play that I can't do any adapting to.
Oh,
I'd like to go back to what I thought was a challenge for me, which was directing a play that had a really tight, ready-made script that I couldn't change.
Mm.
And I would just like to see, now that I know a little more about directing and now that I'm a bit more experienced and mature as a director, like, can I do it?
Yeah.
I think I can, but I guess I'll have to prove it.
Maybe a difficult question to pose, but do you have a favorite Shakespeare play specifically?
As You Like It.
Ooh, okay.
As You Like It is my favorite. You know what? As You Like It's my favorite comedy. And Richard III's my favorite history. I guess I'd have to say Hamlet's my favorite tragedy. It's Hamlet's too good. It's just, it's got some amazing speeches and some amazing scenes. And if you have some really solid actors, you can do a great Hamlet. But I, I would say those are, Hamlet is the only one I haven't directed. I'm sure I'll try it someday. But I don't. I would like to direct Into the Woods. Now, but like everyone does it, so I can't like do it for 10 years. But like I have an idea in the back of my head locked and loaded for Into the Woods, and I'm like, that's a really good idea. Don't tell anyone. You don't want anyone to steal it. Someday you'll direct Into the Woods, and this is what you do. Because I've also never directed a musical before.
Oh, really?
I would like to, but I'm really tough on musicals. Like I teach acting at a college. I teach acting at Monmouth. And I'm always running down musicals to my students, and they are musical theater kids. And I'll be like, I'm sorry, we're going to use a script from a straight play because we want to work with really good writing. We don't want to work with musical theater writing, because a lot of musical theater writing is just trying to get you to the next song.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think I answered an old question and a new question at the same time.
Speaking of teaching, how has your experience directing contributed to your perspective on your style of teaching theater-related courses?
I think that because I'm a director, I can't not be a director. And when I'm teaching acting, I think of myself less as an acting teacher and more as a director who's teaching acting. And that I'm trying to teach young actors skills that would be useful for a director to work with. So it's almost like I'm trying to make them actors that would be easier for me to work with if I were directing them. But, you know, actors or young actors who have never taken a class before are coming in with such a huge range of experience. Some of them have taken a lot of classes and done a lot of plays in high school, and some of them have never acted before when they come to my class and have, like, their experience with acting is just like watching film or television. Maybe they've seen one or two plays before. But that so you're often just, sometimes you're just teaching people how to learn their lines. And then sometimes you're getting into much more advanced, like text analysis and character analysis and making choices. And so because where I teach doesn't have like a really robust theater program, there are only two acting courses. So we can't get that far into it. So I'm kind of thinking about it more in a functional way. You want to be in a play. Let me teach you the tools that you need to be a good collaborator in this play for a director and for your other actors.
Speaking of ACT and kind of students at the same time in the vein of teaching, do you approach student-run productions when you direct them differently than you would a Shakespeare 70 production, say? Or what have you learned from leading those student productions in that way?
In some ways, it is easier to work with ACT because they have so many people working on the production.
Yeah.
I do a production for ACT, and I have, like, two costume designers and three costume assistants. And we don't have that for Shakespeare 70 because it's a volunteer organization. These are, like, adults who all have full-time jobs, and we're doing it for the love of the game. And we just sometimes, you don't have time. Someone doesn't have time to contribute that particular effort. I would say that there's probably some content that I would think would be too difficult for students. You know, I've been having a conversation with some of my friends who are actors because this has changed a lot in the last 20, 25 years since I really started doing theater seriously. Is anything related to like intimacy and physical contact is really different now than it was when I was in college. When I was in college and when I was out of college in like improv school, There were no intimacy coordinators. There was not a real instinct by the director or the people working on the play to be really careful with their actors about how to approach that kind of material. I would say I wouldn't necessarily avoid something that required intimacy if I were working with students, but I would think very carefully about what kind of additional support we might have or what was necessary, and am I going to have the tools to like do it and supervise it? Because I actually haven't worked with an intimacy coordinator, because when I've directed scenes like that, I have been really diligent about making sure that everyone's on the same page and that I'm not asking anyone to do anything that's uncomfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I'm just working with people I've worked with a lot, so there's a level of comfort there. Mm-hmm. But when I'm choosing material for students in class, like that I'm teaching, I think 15 or 20 years ago, you might have handed two kids a scene where they had to kiss, or, oh, this is a scene where you two have just, you know, slept together. Mm-hmm. And now I wouldn't do that.
Mm, yeah.
Because it's in an academic environment, and because it's not, if it were a conservatory acting program where their job was to be there and study acting all day, you would have to give them material like that, because that's what's going to be expected of them when they attempt to work as actors. Mm-hmm. But in an academic environment, I think when I was younger, we wouldn't have thought twice about it. But probably because we wouldn't have thought twice about it, there were people who were really made uncomfortable about it, or who were treated poorly by teachers, by directors, or by colleagues. Now, I just don't think like, oh, I'm doing this for a grade, and what I need to do for a grade is kiss this person. That just doesn't sound appropriate to me. Yeah. It just doesn't sound appropriate. Especially unless it were in like a really robust conservatory program where all day, every day, mm-hmm. you're just studying acting, and this is just part of an actor's work. I mean, it's still sort of weird to think that as an actor, sometimes your job is to go to work and to pretend to have sex with someone for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I did today. Oh, yeah, we shot a sex scene today at work.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. I didn't even think about that, like the difference of just nowadays. Yeah, that would seem like a strange thing to do.
And I don't know that it isn't an overcorrection, and that there isn't somewhere in between, because like for actors and for theater people, our job is like storytelling. Mm-hmm. And part of that is like being creative and being flexible and being open and being able to and willing to push ourselves outside of our comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think I can think about actors that I've worked with, actors that I've seen, and I can see when they're not able to push themselves outside of their comfort zone and when they're not able to do that work, and the piece suffers as a result. But there's a reason why we had to correct. And it was because, you know, I have friends who are a bit older than me who have degrees in theater from really major institutions who have told me just like shocking stories about things that their teachers would say to them or things that their colleagues would do to and with them, all in the name of like, oh, well, you're getting an education as an actor, so you better do this.
Yeah.
And obviously that's something we needed to push back against. I would say maybe we've gone so far as to feel like our impulses aren't to tell the story and to be creative, but the impulse is always to just never be in a position where anyone might be slightly uncomfortable. Because in theater, we want the audience to be uncomfortable sometimes. Mm-hmm. And for the audience to be uncomfortable, we have to be uncomfortable. We do have to challenge ourselves. So I do think we're ultimately going to find the right level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think part of it just is being the person in charge of the production and setting the right tone and making sure everyone you work with is on the right is on the same page. And also realistically picking material that you know you're going to be able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw a production of Spring Awakening in the Black Box a few years ago.
I did not,
and
but
it was
I remember
student
that.
Directed, and it was so terrific. And I know they had used an intimacy coordinator, but I felt like now this is a great use of that role, the intimacy coordinator, but also creating an environment in which the actors knew they were working on challenging material and they knew they were working on material that required some kind of intimacy. And when I watched them do it, I thought these people are really like in the moment. Mm. They're not in their heads. They're not worrying about like what the audience is seeing. And that's a result of good directing. It's a result of intimacy coordination. It's a result of people really just having conversations and taking care of each other. And so I know it can be done, but it is, it a lot's changed in the last 10 or 15 years as far as that's concerned.
Mm-hmm. This is a fascinating segue.
I've been trying to come up with like a good segue into the next question. And I'm like, how do we, I don't know. I think it might have to be abrupt.
Go ahead.
Tell us a little bit about Taming of the Shrew.
That actually is a good segue in Taming of the Shrew, in our production, all of the characters that are originally written as men mm-hmm. are played by female actors.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters that are originally written as women are played by male actors. And there are times where female actors are touching or behaving towards the male actors in a way that we would look at and say, that's not appropriate, that's creepy, that's assault, mm-hmm. that's wrong. Any version of that. So we're doing that on purpose because we want to see if and how it actually changes how the play is received, as like who's saying the words and who's here and now who's receiving the words, who's performing these actions and who's receiving these actions.
Mm-hmm.
But no, there have certainly been conversations about like, okay, and she needs to touch you here. Is that okay? Where are you comfortable? Are you comfortable with that? Are you comfortable mm-hmm. with this? Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think sometimes, and I have actors across generations in this play. I have people who are Gen Z and I have people who are Gen X. Mm-hmm. And then I have people who are millennials. So we have a range of close to 30 years from the youngest to the oldest person in the cast. And not everyone comes into it with the same cultural baggage, with the same sort of tolerance for bad behavior. Mm-hmm. I think we found in rehearsal that some of the older actors, and I don't mean older as in a drag, they're all close to my age. So mm-hmm. like the actors like around my age have a higher tolerance for like bad behavior mm-hmm. because they've endured it for much longer. And because they grew up at a time where that bad behavior was much more normalized and was less likely to be called out.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, things that like the men in the play, the male characters might be saying too and about the female characters don't land as hard on them as they might on some of the younger actors.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I also don't want to like, I don't want to paint with so broad a brush because everyone has their own individual reaction to these words. But I think one of the reasons to try the play is because there are such complicated gender politics in the play. And I think I thought it might be interesting to hear these words coming out of a woman's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And how would that change things for the audience?
Mm-hmm.
Does it change things for the audience? And I won't know until the audience comes. When I watch it, it's hard for me to watch it and not be aware that this is a female actor speaking these words. Even though she's playing a male character, I see that she's a female actor because we're not trying to hide that from the audience. Mm. None of the female actors in the play are doing an impression of a guy that you would be like, wow, she totally disappeared and she like became that. And that's deliberate. Like, we want the audience to be aware that it's women playing men.
Yeah.
And that's part of the prickliness and the complication of the play. And in some ways, this is a little more experimental than some of the other Shakespeare plays I've directed, because the idea hinges on an experiment. Mm-hmm. What if we switch these? Now, this is certainly not the only production to ever gender swap Taming of the Shrew, or gender swapped Shakespeare productions have existed for many, many years. But I think our version probably is doing some things that others haven't done. I don't know. I haven't seen them. But we're definitely not hiding from the audience the fact that these are female actors putting on and playing these roles. Because we actually, when we see them for the first time, we see them as themselves. We see them as women, and then the play begins, and then they sort of choose to take on these roles.
Mm-hmm. So why Taming of the Shrew? Why is it so important to put the show on now?
Well, I am a little concerned about how loud some voices in the culture have gotten that seem pretty misogynistic to me, and that seem to be, I would say, embracing a very hard and fast traditional view of what gender is and of what gender roles are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And the final speech in The Taming of the Shrew, which is a speech in which the character Kate basically tells us what she's learned about how to be a good wife. Mm. Some of the things that she says don't sound too different from what people are saying on mainstream platforms and with a fairly wide audience. Mm-hmm. And I would say that is the primary reason why I thought, okay, this play is worth picking up. Because maybe 10 years ago, I would have been like, oh yeah, this play should be sitting on a shelf collecting dust because it's kind of gross. And I can't reconcile the gender politics of it. Now I would say, well, this final speech sounds like something you could hear on a podcast. Sounds like something you could hear on cable news from commentators, from pundits. Certainly sounds like something that would be on other social media platforms. So I think that was the way into it. I think if the last 10 years hadn't happened, it just feels like those voices have gotten louder and they have gotten a platform that feels more welcoming. And it feels like those voices are, I don't want to say mainstream, but they have a platform that suggests that they have the mainstream in their sights. And that does feel really troubling. And it also, I read that speech and I'm like, well, Shakespeare really has an ear for misogyny, for like this power dynamic that can exist between men and women. I hope that what we end up with is at least worth like the audience's discussion. We have two more rehearsals and a lot can still change. I mean, I in my head, I know what the end of the play looks like. I know what that speech sounds like. I'll be interested to see how the audience receives it.
Mm-hmm. That's a fantastic point to set people up in order to be intrigued to see the show in the upcoming week. Thank you so much, Kurt.
Great.
Answering our questions here today. Tickets for Taming of the Shrew are currently available right now through the TCNJ Center for the Arts website for performances through October 15th and through October 19th. And additionally, if you are interested, Sigma Tau Delta, the English Honor Society on campus, is hosting dinner and a show event on Wednesday, October 15th, where you receive a nice dinner in addition to your ticket to the show's opening that night. And tickets are currently available for that in the Bliss Hall English office. Kurt, do you have any final thoughts or anything to say about Taming of the Shrew?
Tickets are only $5 for students. When I was a student, I graduated in 2002, I paid $5 for tickets for Shakespeare 70 plays. So one of our missions is to make sure that people have access to theater at a really affordable cost, and that you really don't have to go anywhere. You know, it's on your campus, whether you live here or whether you come here for class, it's easily accessible to you. Getting to New York or getting to Philadelphia and seeing a play in either of those venues, those productions I'm sure are great, but it's going to be a lot of time and it's going to be a lot of expense. So part of our job here is just to provide access. And part of that access is that the play is really affordable.
Mm-hmm. Again, thank you so much for being here and talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.